Nuclear blind spots. The Radiation Exposure Compensation Act, or RECA, provides one-time payments to individuals, including uranium miners and downwinders, who developed specific cancers from U.S. nuclear weapons testing and the resulting radiation exposure. The program began in 2020 and was reauthorized in 2025, expanding eligibility to areas like St. Louis, Missouri, and it's active through the end of December 2027. So that's one nuclear problem done and dusted, right? Well, not completely. See, not all areas of contamination by U.S. nuclear weapons materials are covered by RECA, and large portions of the population have been left out. It takes a specialist in identifying radiation exposure areas to parse out what's wrong with this way, even after this updated RECA has been rolled out. And when he tells you,
status in this program should not be a political decision, but it's more objective or fairer to make it be guided by where is the contamination. So I, as an analytical person, I look at the environment and I can say, let's go around the American West. I can show you right where the Nevada fallout is or right where the Trinity fallout is in different ways. And with that information, you can say, well, here is where the evidence supports inclusion in RECA.
And it's not just in the American West. Well, when Dr. Michael Ketterer, who has a PhD in analytical chemistry and has worked for the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency's Office of Enforcement, among his many credentials, when he points out how politics has deflected attention from some of the areas most severely impacted by radiation release and exposure, you get yet another look at how we're exposed to that awful, dangerous, deadly seat that we all share.
Nuclear hot seat, what are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat, what have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat, the corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are linking. Nuclear hot seat, it's the bomb.
Welcome to Nuclear Hot Seat, the weekly international news magazine keeping you up to date on all things nuclear from a different perspective. We're a show for people who know nothing about nuclear who want to know something, and people who know something about nuclear who would like to know just a little bit more. My name is Libby Halevy. I'm the producer and host, as well as a survivor of the nuclear accident at Three Mile Island from just 1 mile away. So I know what can happen when those nuclear so-called experts get it wrong. This week, a look at what the Radiation Exposure Compensation Act, or RECA, is not covering, and what needs to happen in order to expand it to cover affected communities in Piketon, Portsmouth, Ohio, California, and even Palomares in Spain. We talk with Dr. Michael Ketterer, a biochemist who, since the year 2000, has been conducting studies of plutonium in the environment and has analyzed samples from locations worldwide, including in soils near the former Rocky Flats facility in Colorado, and fingerprinting off-site contaminants near the former Portsmouth gaseous diffusion plant in southern Ohio. We will also have nuclear news from around the world, numbnuts of the week for outstanding nuclear boneheadedness, and lots more honest and verified nuclear information. All of it coming up in just a few moments. Today is Tuesday, February 17, 2026, and here is this week's nuclear news from a different perspective. Here in the U.S., the Department of Energy is rapidly deregulating federal reactor safety and security standards and rules in order to expedite at least 3 experimental designs of 11 untried nuclear reactors. The DOE cuts are intended to speed up licensing, construction, and operational testing phase so as to achieve reactor criticality by fasten your seatbelts here, by July 4th, 2026. And happy fireworks to you, too. But as National Public Radio reported on January 28, 2026, the new rules and standards for reactor safety and security of unproven experimental reactor designs have not yet been publicly released. The new rules are being rewritten to alter 50 years of duly promulgated regulatory law by the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission, not to bolster public safety, national security, and environmental protection, but to hasten the deployment of unproven, untested, and still dangerous nuclear power technology. At the same time, the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission has announced a major reorganization that will regroup the agency's work around three business lines, not lines to protect people and the environment, as they were tasked with so many years ago, but business lines, the first being new reactors. We all know where that's going. They're just going to green light them and push them forward. Existing reactors. They're going to keep extending the operational life of reactors, which was initially supposed to be 20 years and is now pushing 80. And the third area will be nuclear materials and waste, which will be ignored and just dumped into indigenous lands or poor communities or communities of color, far away from the white male billionaires who run the industry. There's an article we're going to link to from the New York Times by W.J. Hennigan, Bill Hennigan, entitled Trump's Indecent Nuclear Proposal. And he goes into how the failure to renew the New START Treaty, our last nuclear arms limitation deal with Russia, is the cornerstone of some really flawed thinking about future nuclear arms discussions, specifically involving China as well as Russia. Hennigan quotes Alexandra Bell, who was the Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for Nuclear Affairs in the Biden administration, saying that while getting China engaged in arms control talks was a worthy goal, Mr. Trump's all-or-nothing approach was counterproductive. She said, quote, "The idea that we should forsake a half-century worth of effort to create stability between the U.S. and Russian arsenals for a nebulous attempt at a trilateral agreement is foolish, bordering on reckless." We'll have a link up to that article on our website, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode, number 764. And now,
Nuclear Hot Seat, Nuclear Hot Seat, Nuclear Hot Seat, numbnuts of the week.
It's not bad enough that we've used radioactive nuclear materials to contaminate, damage, and otherwise trash planet Earth. Now, we're bent on extending our destructive nuclear reach to other heavenly bodies, like the moon? Yes, that's right. Russia and China are already collaborating on a joint project to install a nuclear reactor on the moon between 2033 and 2035 in order to power their planned International Lunar Research Station. But the U.S. isn't ready to give up on being first in the nuclear-driven lunar land grab. So we're aiming to get one of our reactors up there by 2030, only 4 years from now. Never mind that we do not have a tested, functioning, small modular nuclear reactor available to send to the moon. Promises are cheap, even as nuclear is insanely expensive. So the nukesters will promise us, well, the moon, while also promising safety and downplaying the likelihood of catastrophic failure. But still, that is going to put plutonium on the moon, with no plan to remove it or take responsible care of the high-level radioactive waste that will result or mitigate for any accident. We have no idea what a nuclear meltdown on the moon would look like, given that the moon has no atmosphere, no weather, and only 1/6 of the Earth's gravity. So, computer models claim that instead of explosion, mushroom cloud, and aftershock, the reactor might simply overheat, perhaps producing an initial flash, then a glowing pool of molten metal that cools and solidifies in silence. In silence where no one can hear you scream. Without air or wind to carry radioactive dust, fallout would remain largely local. but still dangerous nearby, and, it being plutonium, lethal for up to 500,000 years. Do we really want to risk this? We've already contaminated the cosmos by deliberately crashing the Cassini spacecraft into Saturn in September 2017, ending its 20-year mission. The experts insist that the probe was destroyed in the planet's upper atmosphere to prevent potential contamination of Saturn's potentially habitable moons. But here's the thing. That probe was powered by 72 pounds, 33 kilograms, of plutonium-238. The so-called nuclear experts claim that this radionuclide, with a half-life of 25,000 years, was vaporized upon entry. But did that render it innocuous? Hardly. Vaporized plutonium remains highly radioactive in that state. In fact, vaporized or aerosolized plutonium is far more deadly to human health than solid plutonium would be because it can be inhaled, making it a severe internal radiation hazard. So what might it have done, still be doing, to the formerly plutonium-free Saturn ecosphere? And given that it takes 10 to 20 half-life cycles for plutonium to become inert, that's between a quarter and 500,000 Earth years that it will still be lethal. What kind of impact might that have had on the formerly pristine planetary environment of Saturn? Now it looks like we're blithely planning to contaminate the moon with long-lived radioactive materials, spreading the contamination further into the cosmos without knowing what the consequences might be. And that's why, to the nuclear brainiacs rushing headlong like lemmings over the cliff into an unknown and radioactive future, on the moon and elsewhere across the skies, you are this week's
Nuclear Hot Seat, Num Nuts of the Week.
In Ukraine, Russia launched its worst ever attack on Ukraine's nuclear-connected substations on February 7, cutting the volume of electricity generated by the country's nuclear power by around 50%, and the situation remains critical. Russia targeted high-voltage substations that connect Ukraine's three operating nuclear plants to the grid, forcing one reactor unit to shut down completely. Electricity is needed at nuclear plants for safety reasons, to run reactor cooling systems. If an active plant is disconnected, it then relies on backup diesel generators to keep operating. If those generators fail, a nuclear meltdown can happen within hours. As the CEO of the Ukraine state grid operator told the Kyiv Independent, it's not a good situation for nuclear safety. Here's this week's featured interview. The Radiation Exposure Compensation Act, or RECA, was originally enacted by Congress in 1990 to provide one-time benefit payments to individuals harmed by atmospheric nuclear weapons tests and uranium mining. It was established following decades of advocacy for workers and downwinders who developed specific cancers after being exposed to radiation that could be traced to U.S. nuclear weapons work. The program was reauthorized in 2025, expanding eligibility to areas like Coldwater Creek in St. Louis, Missouri, and is active through the end of 2027. But there are levels of radiation contamination that are not covered by RECA and should be, and large number of people who deserve to be compensated who have been excluded, in large measure, because the determination of eligibility has been based on political pressure and not science. Leading the push for awareness of the problem from a scientific perspective is Dr. Michael Ketterer. He has a PhD in analytical chemistry and has worked for the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency's Office of Enforcement and at the University of Denver. He is Professor Emeritus of Chemistry and Biochemistry at Northern Arizona University. Since 2000, Michael has been conducting studies of plutonium in the environment and has analyzed samples from locations worldwide, including in soils near the former Rocky Flats facility in Colorado, and fingerprinting of off-site contaminants near the former Portsmouth gaseous diffusion plant in southern Ohio. He has also uncovered previously unknown areas of radiation contamination by U.S. weapons production and testing in California and elsewhere around the United States. I spoke with Michael Ketterer on February 9, 2026. Dr. Michael Ketterer, welcome back to Nuclear Hot Seat.
Thanks very much. Glad to be with you again on the show.
You have been working on a wide range of issues, most recently on RECA-related issues, and that's the Radiation Exposure Compensation Act that was passed by Congress and signed by the president. What is your background that brings you into this discussion?
I am a specialist. I'm a chemist, an analytical chemist, an environmental chemist, and more specifically, I study long-lived radionuclides in the environment, most specifically uranium and plutonium. And that's what brings us to RECA, Libby, is that if you think about RECA, the types of contamination that RECA is intended to address are uranium mining and milling and fallout from atomic testing in the American West, both Trinity and Nevada. And then there's some other things in there, such as the Coldwater Creek site in Missouri. So the new RECA in 2025 involves intimately contamination that I'm familiar with. So my view on really how RECA should work, Libby, is that status in this program should not be a political decision, but it's more objective or fairer to make it be guided by where is the contamination. So I, as an analytical person, I look at the environment and I can say, let's go around the American West. I can show you right where the Nevada fallout is or right where the Trinity fallout is in different ways. And with that information, you can say, well, here is where the evidence supports inclusion in RECA. A very good example, which we've talked about before, is Inyo and Mono counties in California. And I'm not done with that one yet, because now in the next year and a half to 2 years that we have to make a new RECA happen, all of this information, my viewpoint here is all of this information about where the contamination is needs to be included into that decision-making process. It shouldn't be something that's based on a group of people from an affected area. Of course, this is how politics does work. A group of people from an affected area gets together and they put pressure on Congress. The success story there, of course, is the Tularosa Basin downwinders, who I give tremendous credit to Tina Cordova et al. There. But the process is really the people who are harmed have to be working with their members of Congress, and it becomes a political process. And my view here, Libby, is I'm an evidence-based person, and I'm saying I can take you around North America and I can show you where all of the contamination of all these flavors is in 2026. So some examples of that in New Mexico, I can show you the areas where the Trinity fallout is and in New Mexico and where it is not. And those are pretty specific geographically. And there's different layers of fallout. There's not only plutonium, there's the volatile radionuclides like the iodine, and the breadcrumbs that that left behind is a different story and how it's distributed in the environment. But the point of all this, Libby, is I think that in the creation of a newer and better, we have to look at all this evidence. We have to understand it. And we have to say, we need to pay attention to these places. They may have no advocate. They may not have effective advocates. They may have advocates that, you know, are at each other's throats and in conflict with each other. But there needs to be, in my mind, a sound, consistent, and objective way to say Inyo and Mono counties in California are, from my lens, pretty close to the same thing as the southwestern counties in Utah with respect to their Nevada content. And of course, I can name the counties in New Mexico where Trinity fallout is. And there's other counties in New Mexico that have other types of contamination from other aspects of the atomic weapons program. In Colorado, I can say, here's Rika-like contamination around Rocky Flats. Here's more of it around Canyon City, the former Cotter Mill. And then here's in the southwestern part of the state, here's all of these places. I'll also mention I'm discussing with the group Concerned Citizens Against Toxic Waste in Canyon City, Jerry Fry, Carol Dunn et al. I'm going to actually meet with them tomorrow and talk about a project we're going to do together to try to bring more attention, because they were left out of RECA. Also turning to evidence in RECA, Southern Ohio, Pike, and Scioto counties, let me just say very explicitly, those were the two most glaring emissions of the last version of RECA that was passed. I'll put it this way. Does it make sense that areas near Paducah, Kentucky, former gaseous diffusion plant, and Oak Ridge, Tennessee, former gaseous diffusion plant, those became parts of RECA, but Southern Ohio, near the largest and dirtiest of the three gaseous diffusion plant, where the high volume production of high enriched uranium was done in the Cold War at Piketon. Piketon, Piketon, Piketon. Pike and Scioto County, Ohio, were left out. And see, this is what makes no sense. If you think about the evidence, they used politics to leave out the worst place. And ignorance leaves out a place like Inyo and Mono County, California. Nobody there even knows they're contaminated. The people that live there, maybe they've been affected, maybe they've not, but I don't know that there's anybody in those counties that understands any of this. I have a very unusual perspective on RECA, and I consider myself in a position to help inform the next RECA process to make it more robust so that we honor where the contamination is.
So it sounds like what you're saying is that RECA, for whatever good that it has done so far, is still woefully incomplete, and the pieces need to be filled in, and it will be coming up for renewal again in 2 years?
Yes, I think you are hitting the nail on the head, my friend, in that the RECA process that was reauthorized for a short period of time in July 2025 through the end of calendar 2027, we now have this window. There is a new process that is better than the previous one, which had completely lapsed and there was a gap. But the new process now includes all of New Mexico, and it includes other additional areas. And I don't want to get into factual trouble as to what is included versus not, but Piketon, and specifically Pike and Scioto counties, are not included. And my point here is, in the next process to replace what expires in 2027, my perspective is, let's honor the data. I don't disagree at all that everything that is in the current inadequate process needs to be covered by RECA. I do not dispute that at all. My view is simply there's so many other places that just are forgotten because either of ignorance or they don't have the advocacy to do it.
Tell us about the Palomares incident and how that accident factors into RECA.
Very few people are aware of January 17th, 1966 accident that happened. You could call it more of a disaster than an accident, but it happened over Spain, and it was the U.S.'s responsibility. During the Cold War, the U.S. Air Force's Strategic Air Command would fly routes from the United States over the Atlantic, several different routes, and then they would fly essentially over NATO territory and to the borders of the Soviet Union and then turn around, armed with nuclear warheads. So this was happening basically continuously during the late 50s and through the 60s. It was discontinued, I think, in the early 70s with detente and Brezhnev. It was eventually discontinued. Now, during these routes, a B-52 would be refueled in midair using a tanker plane. So the KC-135 is a tanker plane, and the midair refueling operation is needed to keep the planes aloft in the skies at all times before they return to their base and the next one goes out. The U.S. had an agreement with Spain that Eisenhower started in the 1950s, I think it was 1953, to access the Iberian Peninsula with bases. So the U.S. established a naval base at Rota in southwestern Spain on the Atlantic side, and they established a couple of Air Force bases. These were used, one of the Air Force bases, I think it's called Morón, was used to refuel the planes that flew over Spain. Well, that all went wrong on the morning of January 17th, 1966. A mid-air crash happened, both planes destroyed, 7 American crew members killed, all of the people in the tanker killed, several of the bomber crew survived. But there's 4 nuclear warheads, megaton range, thermonuclear H-bombs on this plane. One of them fell into the Mediterranean Sea. One of the bombs, its parachute opened, and it landed essentially intact with some dents, you might say. It was found by a local person. The other 2 bombs mechanically destructed to the point that the plutonium was scattered in the surface soil on windy day and in a windy area. That's really the tragedy of Palomares from the environmental standpoint, is that scattering of the plutonium from these 2 destroyed bombs. The contaminated soil, in essence, is still there. It has not been ever properly remediated. The people live in and around it. It's an area of tomato fields, and tomatoes are a big crop there. I took a visit there, a self-guided little visit in October of 2023, and could kind of see. I went right to the site of where one of the bombs has fallen. It's at the Palomares Cemetery, and you can park your car there, and there's nobody around, and there, you know, there's a fenced off area, and there's a sign that says área restringida, restricted area, okay? There's a restricted area there, but it's not really marked as to what happened here, but there's contaminated soil around everywhere. I did not take any samples because it involves customs matters to send samples to the United States, especially of soils from another country. I have not done any of that, of course, but, you know, just looking around, you can see from the maps that are available on the internet where the contaminated areas are. And it's sort of a pattern of the place seems to be oblivious of everything. The local people know it, but that's the Palomares accident. The U.S. is responsible for it. It has never properly addressed this. People in Spain have wanted to get this cleaned up, but the U.S. has lacked the political will to do it.
Where does the United States stand now as regards Palomares, and how do you believe it should fall in under RICA?
I think where the United States is right now is, except for people who are specialists, say you really, really pay close attention to nuclear issues and you know about Broken Arrow accidents like Palomares or Thule, Greenland 2 years later.
Explain just a little bit about what a Broken Arrow incident is.
The term Broken Arrow is used in reference to some type of an accident involving nuclear weapons, e.g. where nuclear materials were scattered in the soil at Palomares is considered a Broken Arrow by the language of the military. There was a very similar accident from the same type of Strategic Air Command refueling route that occurred over the Greenland ice caps in one of the other routes that's going over the northern part of the northern hemisphere. So there was plutonium scattered on the Greenland ice cap, and it is still there, and it's been studied scientifically. Both of these accidents, Libby, have been studied scientifically, and this is why I know of both of them about 20-odd years ago when I said to myself, I think I'm going to go study plutonium here and there. Palomares is one of the first things you read about, and it's a very well-known scenario among people who would want to study plutonium contamination and fingerprinting and where it's coming from. It's pretty well known among technical specialists. The Spanish government has an arm called CIEMAT, C-I-E-M-A-T. CIEMAT has the responsibility for environmental and nuclear oversight in Spain. They have a couple of nuclear reactors, and they also have oversight responsibility for Palomares. CIMAT has laboratories in Madrid. I've visited there. I've given a seminar, met people there from the professional side of my work. But I think the tragic situation is now the United States isn't really paying any formal attention to it. I would bet you that you could count on maybe a couple hands how many members of Congress will have heard of Palomares. I wonder what is the answer to that question. You know, there's certainly plenty that are old enough to have seen and heard about it. And actually, John Kerry in 2015, when he was Secretary of State under the latter part of Obama's presidency, there were talks starting with Spain about remediation and so on. But in the end, there's no attention paid in the United States. So I'm looking at this from the standpoint of RICA would be a very convenient political vehicle for the United States to do many things. One is acknowledge that we caused this and we left it there and it wasn't right. And we bear some responsibility 60 years later for doing something to fix it, to take care of our vecinos, you know, our neighbors on the other side of the Atlantic that have been affected by this that we have ignored. And I'm just speaking on behalf of the United States here, and my view is as a citizen of this country. It seems to me I'm not in a position to say anything yay or nay about how Spain has conducted their side of the affairs, but this is, of course, a problem that occurred under Francoist fascist dictatorship Spain during that time. And Franco consented to allowing these flights to go over the Iberian Peninsula to refuel from bases in Spain, and so that it would enable the planes to go fly over Turkey up to the Soviet border and wave hello to the Soviets and then turn around and fly back. It was in one of those turn around and fly back to head back towards North Carolina that the fatal accident occurred.
We'll be back with the second half of this week's featured interview with Dr. Michael Ketterer in just a moment. But first, each week, the nuclear industry provides us with new nightmares and revelations of old nightmares. But you couldn't tell any of it was happening if all you follow is mainstream media. That's why Nuclear Hot Seat exists, to give a caring, compassionate, and concerned person like you a regular weekly dose of honest nuclear news that you can count on. Nuclear Hot Seat is the longest-running program that focuses exclusively on nuclear issues. Now in its 15th year as a podcast and 10th year as a broadcast over Pacifica, we have a long history of scooping mainstream media on nuclear issues, giving context and continuity to local, national, and international stories. And we work behind the scenes, providing links and introductions between activists, researchers, and reporters so that the honest nuclear story gets out far beyond this show. That's why you can count on Nuclear Hot Seat to provide you with verifiable, fresh information and an unrelenting perspective every week. But in order to keep doing this work, we need your help. This show runs on donations, and we're always in need of your support. So how about $5? The same as one would spend here in the U.S. for a nice cup of coffee and a tip to the barista. Or buy Nuclear Hot Seat a cup of coffee a month with a recurring donation of $5. Or more if you can. Of course, be it a one-time help or ongoing, your donation can be any amount. And all of it counts towards our monthly nut. Nuclear Hot Seat is a 501c3 nonprofit organization, which means that your donations are tax deductible. You can donate to us by going to nuclearhotseat.com, and there you have it, the red donate button. If you have Zelle, you can send money directly to info@nuclearhotseat.com. Don't wait. Go to nuclearhotseat.com to donate right now, and know that whatever you can do to help, I'm deeply grateful that you're listening and that you care. Now here's part two of this week's featured interview with Dr. Michael Ketterer.
You're talking about expanding RECA to be able to cover Palomares in Spain. Yet there are so many areas in the United States that, as you pointed out, still need coverage as well. Is the RECA program, as it currently exists, robust enough to be able to expand, first of all, to the places in the United States and beyond that to Palomares in Spain?
I think inherent the mechanisms that we are using now are going to hit some limits that will make it difficult for the current RECA to really be expanded to the scale that it needs to be. And I would say RECA is inadequate domestically in many, many places. And we've been talking today about Piketon and those counties and the ones in California as well. But RECA also, in my mind, has an opportunity to cover a small, focused, localized area which does not have a large population. And it's an American-caused problem. I say it this way. Palomares is as American as baseball, hot dogs, apple pie, and Chevrolet. Palomares is all American as all that, Libby, because consider, the pits that blew up at Palomares, and those atoms are in the soil today, they were made at Rocky Flats. The plutonium in those pits was produced at Hanford. It was refined using chemistry developed at Argonne, and it was built into pits that were designed at Los Alamos. So Palomares is an all-American problem. I look at it that way, honestly. You know, we caused it. So back to your question of, do we have the wherewithal or the resources? RECA needs to be expanded to cover everything that's contaminated. And let's start with that first and then start talking about the resources, because you don't want to go down the slippery slope of saying these sites are worse than those sites. Because if you do, then it's triage and it becomes really bad. And I think the other comment I have on RECA is we have to reduce the burden of proof that people have to make. The burden of proof for applications in RECA, so that's Radiation Exposure and Compensation Act for citizens or inhabitants who lived in the affected areas, there's always a burden of proof on the applicant. Similarly, in former nuclear workers, there's legislation that covers that, and there's also a fairly substantial burden of proof on those former workers to prove you got exposed from that source. RECA has some kind of a presumption of the government didn't do it, and you have to prove that we did it. I think we have to think a bit more about that presumption. It's more like if you lived in this area at that time, and it says cancer or so-and-so on your death certificate, end of story. It turns into a very arbitrary judgment that's made in the application process where people who really should be included are not. And it, through because of, you know, they can't put the application documentation together or something like that. You should ask the Tularosa Basin downwinders about how is it going and what do people have to prove. I think that there's a lot of things that the government could do to make that much better.
Given that there is burden of proof, there is an awkwardness, there is a maybe I'm covered, maybe I'm not aspect to this, how have signups to RECA been going in terms of the number of people signing up versus the number who we can project would be eligible for the program?
I would again refer you to the Tularosa Basin downwinders. They have at their fingertips that kind of data. But I know, broadly speaking, there are lots of applications going in. And there also are, you can see them driving around on the interstates, billboards. There's companies or private individuals who are sort of soliciting RECA would-be claimants so that they can get a commission. And there's constraints in the law on the commissions. But the message of the downwinders is there's no reason to pay somebody $2,000 or $3,000 to get your money because the government is supposed to do this for you. And we are here to help you figure the claimant process out. I think my point here is when I think about who was affected by all of these different types of contamination that are currently envisioned to be RECA things. Where did all the Nevada stuff go? Where did all the Trinity stuff go? Where did all the Coldwater Creek-like stuff go now that you opened that door? And where did all the Paducah and Oak Ridge-like stuff go now that you've opened the door of Paducah and Oak Ridge? Why have you left the door of Piketon closed? Senator Hawley, you have failed Piketon, Ohio, my friend. Yeah, you did a great thing for your constituents in Coldwater Creek, and I believe they deserve this every bit as much as you got them. And you did your job as a senator on behalf of your constituents. You did not do your job as an American on behalf of your fellow Americans in Piketon, Ohio. And that goes for everyone else that voted for this. You know, the senators in New Mexico, you collectively are all ignorant of where the contamination is. And my goal here, Libby, for the next year and a half is just to shine a light on that ignorance. Let's talk about where are all the contaminated places. Let's look at the reality of what Palomares is and what is Piketon and what is Inyo County, California, Unicoi County, Tennessee, Fremont County, Colorado. I could go on just trying to bring attention in an objective manner to where is it contaminated and where is it not.
What steps are you taking or planning to take in the near future into public awareness, and especially awareness in the hearts and the minds of those who can actually do something about it?
Well, thank you. Those are two really critical questions. I'm doing two things. I'm working with Veterans for Peace in New Mexico. We have a core team that has built a mobile environmental testing laboratory that is focused on RECA. And that is actually still in prototype stage, but it is fully operating and it has completed its first study on location where I am right now in New Mexico.
What is it testing and how is it testing?
What it is it's a 17-foot RV type trailer, and inside is an analytical instrument that's called a mass spectrometer. It's the exact same thing that I have in a laboratory in Flagstaff for doing testing on site, wherever we take the trailer, of the same radionuclides, plutonium, neptunium, uranium, thorium, heavy metals like lead and arsenic and chromium and things like that as well. We have this now established as a working tool. It's not fully complete, but it's operating right now because it has already produced its first report, actual data on real unknown samples. A group somewhere else in the United States sent a package of samples, and I prepared seven mixtures for uranium isotopic analysis. And the question at hand is yay or nay, is there depleted uranium here?
So you're working to get this lab up and fully operational to test the soil or test the people?
This is for environmental testing. This is not intended at this time in any manner for any type of biological testing. I am, in general, somebody who follows the pathways of these radionuclides in soil, water, air, plant matter, but I do not really intend to study human exposure. I sort of take the position that I'm going to show you that the contamination got to your house, and you're going to have to worry about how much of that you're exposed to, or that's the next step of determination. The laboratory is intended to test environmental media. I'll give you an example. Well, on March 11th in Socorro, New Mexico, First We Bomb New Mexico, the film is there's going to be a screening there, and the filmmaker Lois Lipman and Tina Cordova will be hosting a Q&A. Well, I will be there joining them, and we are going to kick off a pro bono water sampling project that basically we will pass out hundreds of little 15 milliliter test tubes, just about a half an ounce of water from people's drinking waters. They'll be labeled serially, 1 to 500. And this mobile laboratory, while stationed here in New Mexico, we're looking for I'd call it a docking station. We're looking to rent a building for a year. Right now it's at somebody's house, but we're looking to rent a building for a year. But in this particular project, we are going to recruit water samples, and then we're going to tell people in a short report, and this is all pro bono, here are the concentrations of uranium, lead, arsenic, and chromium. That's four contaminants. Arsenic is technically not a heavy metal. The other three are. So there's arsenic and three heavy metals that are contaminants of concern in New Mexico in different places. Lead is always a concern in people's plumbing. So the Downwinders and Veterans for Peace are going to do this joint project using this community laboratory as a tool. And with a couple of days and the participation of maybe a couple of volunteers, I'm going to twist some arms and get some people to help me so I don't have to do all 500 samples by myself. But the plan is, after the film screening concludes, we're going to have a very short timeline on bringing your water samples, and we'll have plenty of these passed around through all sorts of manners elsewhere. But we're going to assemble information. I will be blind so that I don't know what is from where. I will be writing reports that say, "Dear sample 152. I need to be blind in this, and we have yet to figure out how we're going to do the work of reporting all of these, but I'm going to be producing 500 pro forma reports with the data results filled in. And we can test the concentrations of all of these versus the drinking water standards, which are, you know, known concentrations, and the whole analysis is calibrated so that the actual concentrations are known, just as they would in any water testing laboratory.
I also understand that you're in the process of writing a book.
Yes.
Tell us about it.
Taking some of my ideas about RECA from the side of where are the contaminants, and also from the human side, where have the effects been? And I have weaved it into a personal story, and I call it My Fallout Family. And what this book is about is, in three sections, I want to make the case that pretty much everywhere in the United States, people were harmed by one type of fallout or another. And in some locations, many locations, they were harmed by other types of radioactive contamination that is in one way or another related to the Cold War. So in My Fallout Family, I have three sections. The first is largely about a lay description of the science that I do, the radioisotopes that I'm talking about, which ones are the signature contaminants for what types of industries. What do you look for in the environment if you're thinking about a gaseous diffusion plant or a uranium mill? These are all very easy things for me to actually do with this community environmental lab tool. So the first section of the book is about how to. It's kind of like a field guide. If citizens wanted to do this yourself, it explains how you would go gather soil, whatever. The second part is more about geography, and it's going to get more specific, geography and history. And it's going to say, here are some places in America, and Palomares is going to be in there as well. Here are some places that, you know, are not in the current RECA, but they follow this model that I have developed about what does RECA contamination look like. If I can go back for just a second. In the first part of the book, I'm also proposing a model that's based on environmental contamination. It's sort of like hypothesis testing from analytical data will say, yay or nay, this looks like RECA contamination. So in the final part of the book, however, which is the most important, I call that My Fallout Family, the namesake of the book. It's a series of stories, about a dozen of them, and it's about individuals. All of them, except for possibly one or two, are deceased. And it finishes with three stories that I know well: my own cousin, my own brother, and my own mother. And I explain in my own terms, and it's all circumstantial, and to varying degrees of what I would consider proof. I believe that that case can be made that just about any American who, you know, really was born anywhere where, you know, lived at any time past 1945, any American just about in the continental United States and elsewhere too, like Palomares, we've all been affected one way or another. You know, I was not around in time or space when Trinity happened, and I was born in Western New York, and my greatest exposure comes from certain specific things. So if I can mention a little bit about my mother's story, she was born in 1927, grew up in Milwaukee, and it does say lung cancer on her death certificate. But during the 1950s, she worked for the U.S. Army. And I know that she was stationed in Fort Riley, Kansas. And I'm researching the date. And Mom was heavily exposed to fresh Nevada fallout while stationed in Kansas is quite clear. And by researching the dates, I can directly compare those dates to when Mom was stationed there versus when the Nevada tests were. And get this, my sister told me a story that Mom got sick and Grandma and Grandpa came from Milwaukee while she was at Fort Riley in Kansas. And Mom convalesced for a couple of months and then went back to Fort Riley. I developed the hypothesis, did Mom get low-level radiation poisoning from fresh Nevada fallout? Iodine-131, that's 1 or 2 days old. Well, Mom was a civilian employee for the U.S. Army, and she worked at recreation centers. They would do indoor games and outdoor games, you know, badminton and volleyball and stuff like that. In good weather, when the tests were happening in Nevada, she would have been out in the afternoons playing badminton and volleyball with the winds carrying the fallout. So the book talks about circumstantial evidence like that. My cousin Suzanne Lipinski was born in 1949, and she died of multiple myeloma in 1991. She lived her whole life in Milwaukee, essentially, and I make a case there for Suzanne being a fallout victim. I think it's the strongest of all the cases that I have in the book.
This is something that you have intrigued me about and certainly teased us about. When do you believe the book will be finished and published?
I don't really have a plan for publication. My plan is more like this. I want to get the book into a readable format by about the middle of this year. And more than likely, I will just start self-publishing and distributing it in some kind of copyright status myself. I want to have every member of Congress read this so that people can think about this view of RICA. I want to sort of espouse this view to anyone who will listen, who's plugged in and cares about RICA. I think they need to think about it from this perspective that, you know, I'm saying another way using evidence that we are all downwinders. If we want to take that famous saying, I'm saying that in other words, if you include everything that can cause harm, and that includes the global stuff in 1962, 1963, 1964, you know, we are all downwinders, my friend.
And on that happy note, Michael, we, of course, want to keep being in touch with you about your very important work and about this book, which will be coming out in some form or another, hopefully before the end of 2026. And as always, I want to thank you for being my guest on Nuclear Hot Seat.
You bet, Libby. Great to be with you today.
Dr. Michael Ketterer. As for that portable testing lab he was talking about, the Uranium Weapons Working Group of Veterans for Peace has built an analytical surveillance tool, that's what they call it, for investigating long-lived radionuclides in the environment. The analytical information potentially will support residents' claims for compensation as victims of nuclear contamination under RICA. This mobile lab is equipped with an inductively coupled plasma mass spectrometer, that's its full official name, and it's referred to as ICPMS. Similar systems are used widely in labs worldwide for trace elemental analysis of environmental samples. Results produced by the lab will be scientifically defensible, but will be generated essentially in real time on behalf of and with the participation of interested community members. For further information, contact Dr. Michael Ketterer, and we will have links up to his contact information on our website, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode, number 764.
Activists, shout out.
International physicians for the prevention of nuclear war are asking, are you concerned by the direction the world is moving in? Do you want to learn more about nuclear weapons and the risks they pose to human and environmental health? You're listening to the show, so I think we know the answer to that one. Do you want to join global efforts to pull us back from the brink of nuclear war and abolish nuclear weapons? Have you been seeking ways to make change? Well, they want you to know that you're in the right place. IPPNW's 10-month-long Global Classroom will deliver a structured, accessible, and high-quality educational program that strengthens global understanding of the humanitarian and environmental impacts of nuclear weapons, the current risks posed by nuclear weapons, and the actions individuals can take to advance the abolition of nuclear weapons. The program will feature leading experts from the global disarmament movement, academia, the health sector, and the United Nations. The series is designed to build a knowledgeable cohort ready to contribute to our global efforts to safeguard our common future. The Global Classroom will run from February through November 2026, with 12 sessions total, including 10 core lessons. Now, the first one is scheduled for February 10, which is just 2 days from now. And if you're getting this news too late to participate, you can contact IPPNW and ask where the replay is going to be available. They assure us that whether you have been a member of IPPNW for decades and need a primer, or just found us today, this program is for you. And we're coming up on Nuclear Accident Anniversary Alley, and the Clamshell Alliance has come up with a great idea. Now, March 28 is the next No Kings Day, but it's also the anniversary of the Three Mile Island meltdown, where deadly radiation and mass evacuations from the March 28, 1979 nuclear power meltdown in Pennsylvania alerted the U.S. and the world to just some of the lethal consequences of nuclear energy. Now, federal and state governments and the oligarchs and authoritarians who back them are forcing new nuclear power on the American public. So at the No Kings Day march on March 28, let's all carry signs to raise the issue. No kings, no nukes. Remember 3-28-79 meltdown at Three Mile Island? Democracy, no nukes, safe energy, and any other issues you wish to raise. But make certain that you always raise March 28, Three Mile Island. I know that's what I'm going to be doing. And if you want further information, we will have links up on our website, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode, number 764. This has been Nuclear Hot Seat for Tuesday, February 17, 2026. If you'd like to get Nuclear Hot Seat delivered via email every week, it's the easiest way for you to keep up with the show and never miss a single episode. You can sign up for it on your favorite podcast channel, but what's really going to help us out, if you go to nuclearhotseat.com, you will see a big yellow opt-in box. Just put in your first name and an email address, and every week you will get one email that includes the link to that week's show as soon as it posts, and a short description of the show's content. We also like to put out the call for any help you can give us with covering your local nuclear stories. So if you have a story lead, a hot tip, or a suggestion of someone to interview, send that information in an email to info@nuclearhotseat.com. And remember, if you can go to Nuclear Hot Seat and donate, that's what we need to keep going, so thank you. Any amount will help us out, and we really appreciate your support. This episode of Nuclear Hot Seat is copyright 2026, Libby Halevi and Nuclear Hot Seat. All rights reserved, but fair use allowed, as long as you cite the program, website, names of any guests whose comments you use, and me. For now, this is Libby Halevi of Nuclear Hot Seat, reminding you, acute radiation illness, such as the massive doses Chernobyl liquidators received, is an accident. But chronic radiation syndrome, such as we are exposed to at low doses from accidents, reactor releases, uranium mining, leftover fallout, weapons manufacture, and radioactive waste, chronic radiation syndrome is a crime. There you have it, your weekly nuclear wake-up call. So whatever you do, do not go back to sleep, because we are all in the nuclear hot seat.
Nuclear hot seat. What are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat. What have those boys been drinking?
Nuclear hot seat.
The corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are leaking. Nuclear hot seat. It's da bomb.